already. Welcome, everybody. This is the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. It is February 22nd, 2017, for the record, and we've got a number of items here. We're going to start out with doing a work session on a bill that we did before. Then I think we're going to do 134, and then we'll move through the list after that, because they're all similar topics. So we will open a work session on Senate Bill 34. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 37, we heard 9 days ago on the 13th, this measure modifies laws relating to commercial driving privileges. At the time, we had a discussion of a change that was necessary on a couple of parts. To that end, we have a Dash 1 amendment, which was accomplished by DMV and the trucking associations. That replaces new language in Section 3 to passenger endorsements. It deletes existing statutory language in Section 6 relating to adoption of rules by the department and modifies the definition of tank vehicle in Section 10 of the bill. With the Dash 1, Mr. Chair, the measure has a minimal fiscal and minimal revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
Just a head nod from Bob and Amy. You're okay at the Dash 1s? Okie dokie with the bill now? Good enough. We're all set. We are in work session. Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 37 with the Dash 1.
No, you got to move the Dash 1 first.
Have we done?
Have we not done the Dash 1.
I thought we did on another one. Okay. I move the Dash 1 amendment.
Thank you. Senator Thompson has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 37. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to that motion? The Dash 1s are adopted. Senator.
Now I move Senate Bill 37 with the Dash 1 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I didn't find any matching plate.
Siri is talking to me. Senator Thompson moves Senate Bill 37 as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Shut up, Siri. More discussion. Seeing none, is there any opposition? There is none. Senate Bill 37 is moved to the floor as amended by the Dash 1s, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a volunteer to carry?
Okay.
Senator Monroe wants to carry. Okay, so we will close on Senate Bill 37. We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 134.
All right, Senate Bill 134 subjects motor vehicle sellers and buyers to certain conditions contingent on the lender agreement or failure to agree to purchase a real tail installment contract or lease agreement for the motor vehicle. We have no amendment before us on this measure, Mr. Chair, and it is up for a public hearing only today, so we don't have the paperwork on that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so I have Cheryl Hemstra?
Hemstra.
DOJ. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Hemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director at the Oregon Department of Justice. The Department of Justice is in this area under our consumer protection laws. And this bill is just a little update. Basically, what's happening in this area is in order to get financing for a vehicle, you can either get a regular lease or what's called a retail installment contract. And then technically under the law, that's credit paper. So this is just updating to use that term, retail installment contract. The second thing it does under existing law, dealers have about 14 days to find financing. So they can deliver a car and say, once we get the financing worked out, we'll do the paperwork afterwards, but here's the car today. When they do that, they've got to send a notice out in case the financing falls through. This just says you can send the notice via electronic communication to help out the dealers, join the modern era here too. So this is just an update bill. We did run it through by the dealers associations back last, I think it was last autumn already, and they didn't raise any concerns with me. I think you're going to be hearing from them today as well. So just a little update bill for you, and I'm happy to take any questions.
So clean up bill, not any real policy shifts at all.
Correct.
Okay, questions?
No, she made the bill much easier to understand than it was to read.
So you understood it?
Now I do.
Well, there you go. You must have done a lot of work on it. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Cheryl. Bill Perry and Daryl Fuller.
I buy a car. I just have Billy bring the checkbook.
That's right.
you opened yourself up to that.
No, that was fine. It was kind of complicated, I thought.
Chair Byers, members of the committee, and Bill Perry with the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. One thing, we're okay with the bill, everything clean up. There was one issue that we had brought up with both the DOJ and that we just wanted to put on the record, and we have by no means want to delay this bill if we can't get it fixed. But in Section 4B of the bill, it talks about that if somebody leaves a lot, then you have 14 days to get this approved. What happens at that point in time, if the approval falls through, we get reimbursed, meaning the dealer, for mileage in those first 14 days, but then they have 5 days to return the car, and you don't get reimbursed for that mileage. The issue is that you know the mileage when they leave the lot, but you have no idea what the mileage is at 14 days. So what that difference is or where that line gets drawn is confusing. And so usually whenever the financing falls through, it's because of the fault of the consumer. Either their income requirements weren't the same, they didn't turn in their pay stubs, they didn't turn in the information that's needed. And so from our standpoint, we should be reimbursed for mileage, period. And so we'd like to obviously have that 5 days taken out. But it's just, you don't know what the mileage is between the 14th and the 15th day. So it's added confusion.
And we don't have an amendment to do that.
No.
We're not going to move this today. Would you like to get an amendment to do that?
Well, be considered? Like I said, we're speaking with the Department of Justice, and so, I mean, like I said, we'll try and work all that out. But we'll probably get an amendment drafted, but whether or not, I mean, we'll...
Well, we can't consider it unless you get an amendment. Yeah. You know. If you wish one, if you want one to be considered, work with Patrick.
Yeah. Okay. Unfortunately, Patrick knows I know how to get a hold of him. So.
I know you do. Thanks, Bill. Mm-hmm. Daryl.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association. There are three different dealer associations in the state, OADA, OIADA, who doesn't appear to be here today, and OBDA. OBDA has about 650 members, making us the largest association. In fact, if you combine the membership of the other two, I think we're probably still larger. That's not pertinent, other than I get a bonus if I mention that on the record, so I appreciate it. I've been in this building for 30 years now. My first session was in 1987. And at the beginning of every session, I say a little prayer and have also said vocally that I would love to see a do-nothing legislature, a legislature that wouldn't do anything for us or do anything to us, just pass a bill and go home. You never seem to find that. And so last fall when the Department of Justice presented this bill to us, and I asked them, well, what does the bill do? And they said, well, it doesn't do anything. And I said, well, what do you mean it doesn't do anything? I said, well, it doesn't change any policies, as the chair indicated earlier. They take some language from here, and they put it over there. And so I double-checked. I said, you're sure that this bill doesn't do anything? And they assured me this bill doesn't do anything. And so I started to hear the alleluia chorus in the back of my mind that somebody finally understood what I've been asking for 30 years. So I commend the bill to you. I encourage you to look for other bills that don't do anything and to pass them as well. That in mind, we're strongly in favor of the bill, and we encourage you to pass it. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
But did you join Senator Thompson, and you can actually read the bill now?
Yeah, I understood it pretty clearly, that everywhere they took out words, they added it in the next paragraph. So that was...
Senator...
Mr. Fuller's bragging about coming in 1987. When he came in 1987, I remember I'd already been here 10 years.
And I remember you well.
Thank you.
And in fact, I interned for the senator that interned for you when he was a student.
We understand that Senator Monroe was here when the state was created.
And I actually have that blue book from your first session. So I think it's on vellum or something.
So. Is he the gold man?
He was a model for the guy on top of the building. Any other questions, folks? All righty. Thank you very much. That's all I have signed up on Senate Bill 134. Is there anybody else who wishes to address this bill? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 134, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 112. Patrick.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 112 requires that carbon monoxide alarms be installed in enclosed structures that have one or more carbon monoxide sources and are occupied and used as food service facilities or for-profit businesses. It specifies that the requirement does not apply to residential structures. The measure has no amendment before us, and again, being scheduled for public hearing only, we do not have paperwork on, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Riley, I believe this one's your bill. Would you
yes.
like to talk from here? Or?
That'll be fine. There is an amendment in preparation, and there's also ongoing talks with DCBS and CCB about this, and I think that we want to just postpone this. It may even go away if those talks go well.
Okay. I hear you. Any questions anybody has on that? Is there anybody in the audience who, do we have any signups? We do not. Is there anybody who wishes to comment on this bill? Seeing none, we will close public hearing on Senate Bill 112. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 127. And Senator, I think this one's yours as well.
Mm-hmm. So, Patrick, go first.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Senate Bill 127 requires a person who advertises, offers, or sells consumer goods to consumers in Oregon to disclose on the offer or advertisement and during the sales transaction the charges that the consumer must pay for handling and shipping of the consumer goods. We also have before us a Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 1 amendment adds a definition of handling and shipping charges and adds language related to periodic shipments to a predetermined term, including shipments for which shipping prices vary. Mr. Chair.
Okay, now, Senator?
So this bill, it's one that several people have talked to me about and I've been thinking about for a while. If you look at the ads on TV, they all say $9.95 plus shipping and handling. And when you get on the phone to them, after you've actually said, yeah, I want it, then you find out the shipping and handling is $27. And, you know, this is a problem because at that point you're going, if I'd known that, I wouldn't have called. But now that I'm on the phone, okay, why not? So this is a problem that's been going on for a long, long time, and this bill seeks to address that. There are a couple of other areas. If they get around that one, you can always put in additional fees. So we covered that in the amendment. And the other thing that happens is you see an advertisement for a series, like a collector series of coins or cars or whatever. And it says, you know, the first one is $9.99 and it's free shipping. And then you get on that list, and then they start being double or triple that on the subsequent ones, and you've already gotten it in the mail when you discover that. So that's covered in the amendment as well.
Okay.
So.
All righty. Well, we have a couple of people signed up. Cheryl Hempster again. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Byer, members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Hiemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director for the Oregon Department of Justice. This one, I'm sorry to tell you, is not quite as simple. So this area has been a particular concern for our Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section at DOJ. As you probably know, we gather a lot of complaints from consumers. We have our consumer complaint hotline folks call into, or they can send complaints in online to our Consumer Protection Section. And so we'll periodically periodically take a look at those and compare that to the law and see if there needs to be any fixes. And Senator Riley dropped this bill on shipping and handling, and we kind of had a fix in the works for this area already. So we were able to work with him to get the Dash 1 amendment. What we see happen, and Senator Riley kind of just outlined it, basically the problem is people are confused or deceived even about what the shipping is going to be. And we've seen some pretty bad companies take advantage of that, especially when you sign up for a service, say you get laundry detergent once a month or something like that. The introductory shipping is free, and then all of a sudden it's up to $20 or something. People have been doing that. So we're here to support the effort. We think more disclosure to consumers about their shipping and handling is good, especially as more commerce moves online, and happy to answer any questions.
So, I guess I have a question, Cheryl. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the bill. I'm looking at the existing statutory language. And when you look at Section 1B or Section 1.2, I see the changes in language there, but it doesn't seem to change the substance of the requirement. The bills or the laws that currently exist seems to say that if you're selling something in the media, whatever media, you have to disclose what the costs are for shipping the consumer goods.
Chair Beyer, I think the biggest difference is in any offer or advertisement, the addition there on line 13, and you may be hearing from Ms. Earls on that point. So this just says that in any offer or ad that you put in what the shipping is going to be. So before you make the phone call, you see it on the ad and say, oh, maybe I don't want to pay $30 in shipping.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, the change is pretty simple. Currently, they have to disclose it before the sale is made. With this bill, they have to disclose it at the time of advertising.
Kind of says that. This is a person that offers for sale, sells or advertises consumer goods,
yeah,
must disclose that.
Must disclose it at what point?
If I may, Chair Beyer, during the sales transaction.
Right.
So that could
during
be
during the sales transaction.
Right. Yeah, it's later. It's not during the advertising, it's during the sale transaction.
Oh, okay, so that gets to your point if you call up and they tell you and it's
right.
$27.
Yeah.
All right, I get it. Senator.
I have a simple question, and that is, how do they know how much it's going to cost to ship it if they don't know where you're from when you call? So the current law is by point of sale, and then it has to be disclosed at the point of sale. But if shipping is, I mean, we all know that if you ship nowadays, you have no idea. If you ship to Delaware, it's going to be one rate. If you ship to a state in Oregon, it might be another rate. So how do you include that in an advertisement?
Chair Beyer, Senator Drodd, great question. I think that was just mentioned before the hearing today, and we're happy to keep talking about that issue. But, yeah.
And my response to that, if I may, is one way to handle that is to understand where the limits are and put that in the ad and say, or less.
So if they ship to Antarctica, it's going to be $700, so you'd have to put in $700.
And you know they're not shipping to Antarctica, so we can ignore that.
Well.
Okay. Anyway, so there's an amendment coming. You're going to address that. Other questions to Cheryl? Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
We'll look forward to the amendment. And Betsy Earls and Elise Brown. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Elise Brown for AT&T. We appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today and offer comments on Senate Bill 127. And let me just provide a little bit of background. I did have an opportunity to speak with Senator Riley briefly when we noticed this bill and let him know. I couldn't remind him because he wasn't in the building then, but this was in the 2013 legislative session. AT&T and other colleagues we worked with, Representative Margaret Doherty, and she passed a bill that was almost identical to this until it was amended through the process and passed. But she had a similar experience with a advertisement, and she was actually in the throes of trying to acquire some samurai shark knives. And so she did have a similar experience, and thus that's why she dropped the bill. So we did work with her, and the results are what is in current law that I think Senator Beyer just summed, and that the charges the consumer pays for shipping and handling are noted during the transaction. So that's at the point that you know. For AT&T, our concern about this bill is what was just mentioned, and you know, this is asking for any kind of advertisement, so print, TV, online, and for our company, AT&T, we have a real broad distribution. So we have customers that go into our stores. We have customers that buy online, and they can go to a variety of different places to pick up our products. So with broad distribution, we have a broad advertisement channels as well. And so I guess my question is, are we going to be required now, if this bill were to pass, to, again, note in every single ad what the shipping and handling costs are going to be to the customer at the notation of the ad? So this is before any transaction takes place, but in the ad, what shipping and handling would be, and I would say we have no idea what that would be. So I understand where you're trying to go with this, and you know, I would just suggest that for our customers, if they're going to order our product online, they get that information when they go through the online process and fill their cart, and the zip code is asked for, and at that point you understand clearly what your liability is going to be for shipping and handling. So I think that this would cause more confusion for the customer and would be really hard for us to administer. So those are my points. I'm happy to work with Senator Riley. I understand the frustration that he's had and heard from his constituents. So if there's an opportunity to work through something, I'd like to do that. So thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries, Oregon Business Association, and the Oregon Retail Council. You may have heard recently that AOI and OBA have merged, and the Oregon Retail Council has for a very long time been part of Associated Oregon Industries. So representing those three organizations. As a group, our members are approximately 1,600 members, and we employ nearly 200,000 Oregonians. Many of our members are retailers who advertise their products and ship them around the country. And as you've already heard from Ms. Hamstra, we are particularly concerned about subsection 2 of the bill that requires shipping and handling costs to be displayed in the advertisement for a product. Our members, when they're writing and approving ad copy, don't have any idea where the purchases will come from in the country. So they don't have any idea how much it will cost to ship a particular product to a particular part of the country. It costs different amounts, obviously, to ship products to different places. And it would be extremely difficult and prohibitive, I think, or discouraging to customers when they're looking at an ad to see that their shipping will cost no more than the most expensive part of the country. And probably it's not going to amount to $700 in Antarctica, but it's, you know, not going to be as cheap as it possibly could be for their own particular location in any case. So that's one concern that we have with it. The other thing is that our customers choose a wide variety of shipping speeds and methods. And those two different factors also change the cost of how much it's going to take to ship, how much they're going to have to pay to get something to them. If they want something to get to them faster, which is a factor the advertiser doesn't know about till they make their choice, that will add to the cost. And if they would prefer something to go by one carrier versus another carrier that's, you know, slower or less reliable in their opinion, that's going to add to the cost. Those are the factors that our retailers will have no idea about customer preference until the person actually makes the purchase. So I understand that DOJ or the AG's office has an amendment to the bill. I also understand that it doesn't address this particular part of the bill. So we'd be happy to work with them on that, but that's of great concern to us.
Thank you. Questions? I see none. Thank you very
much.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on Senate Bill 127? Okay, Senator, I understand where you're coming from. It's the, I guess it's the bad guys and the good guys.
It always
the
is.
People who advertise a very cheap product late at night on TV, and all of a sudden the price of the product, the shipping, becomes five times more than the price. So I get that one. On the other hand, I think Senator Drudd raises some good points.
Right. And I agree that these are all good points. As we all know, if everybody was doing the right thing, we wouldn't need any laws at all. So, you know, that's always the case.
So good luck with working this one out.
Yes.
All right. We're going to close on Senate Bill 127, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 128. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 128 establishes the Hillsborough Airport Authority and the Troutdale Airport Authority as divisions of the Port of Portland. It specifies that the two authorities operate independently of the Board of Commissioners of the Port of Portland and have exclusive right to exercise all power and authority of the port with respect to the Hillsborough and Troutdale airports, respectively. It provides that each airport authority consists of 9 members elected from the county in which the airport is located. This measure comes to us with no amendment in hand. It also comes to us with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, Mr. Chair.
All right, Senator Bradley?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is, again, a constituent-based request. I have lots of constituents who are very concerned about some of the ways that the airport is run, and this bill was put forth with them in mind. I want to note that I've been talking a little bit with some representatives from the port and have asked to talk with more representatives to maybe fine-tune this and see where we're going. But I think we want to hear from everybody here just to see what we're doing.
Thank you. Well, let's start off with Catherine Williams and Vince Granato from the port in Portland. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Williams. I'm the State Affairs Manager for the Port of Portland. We manage the Hillsborough and the Troutdale airports. Before I turn it over to our Chief Operating Officer, Vince Granato, I just wanted to note that I hope you look at OLIS. There's a lot of commentary from partners in East County, where the Troutdale Airport is located, and Washington County, where the Hillsborough Airport is located. And I've appreciated conversations with all of you, including Senator Riley, about the intent of this bill, and look forward to continuing that conversation. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Granato. Thanks.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Vince Granato. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Port of Portland. I'm also a member of the State Board of Aviation, and thank you for allowing me the opportunity to provide some comments on Senate Bill 128, which is a bill proposing the creation of new airport authorities for both Hillsborough and Troutdale. This bill would take the unusual approach of creating two new independent governing bodies within our existing port framework. We don't believe this approach will improve the transparency or the responsiveness to the local concerns, and we're concerned about the negative impact this could have on both these airports. The port and our commission works very hard at both transparency and community involvement. We take great pride in our partnerships with the Troutdale-Hillsborough communities and believe we have meaningful engagement with these communities on airport planning and operations. And I want to take some time and briefly explain how these Troutdale and Hillsborough airports fit within the larger scheme of the regional and national aviation. Both these airports are heavily regulated by the FAA, and this is based in part in the fact that federal funds have been used and will continue to be used to construct the airport's basic facilities. If this structure is put in place, we believe the FAA would likely have to approve the transfer of the authority from the existing Port Commission to the new airport authorities. And we believe this would be unlikely, given without proof that the new arrangement would be as good or better for aviation. The FAA considers Hillsborough and Troutdale as reliever airports in that they accommodate GA traffic that would otherwise have to be fit in at PDX. And as we explain in our letter, Troutdale and Hillsborough are not financially independent. They rely heavily on revenues from PDX for their support. Creating a separate management structure wouldn't change any of these economic facts and would instead, we believe, complicate the financial picture. There's another important aspect of federal regulation to consider here. The new airport authorities proposed in this bill would be subject to the same legal limitations and conditions that currently apply to the port. So, for example, these new authorities would not be able to control where aircraft currently fly. That is in the purview exclusively of the FAA. They wouldn't be able to address airport noise through a curfew. That's also requires FAA approval. They cannot unilaterally ban flight training businesses, and they certainly couldn't also ban the use of certain leaded fuels if there were no substitutes approved and available. And so we really have three primary concerns over this legislation, and I'll talk just a little bit about each of them: community involvement, governance, and finance. So on the community engagement side, we certainly understand and recognize that the operations that happen at these airports have community impacts, and we work hard to mitigate these. And we've submitted a summary of our existing programs and community engagement and noise mitigation in the packet. But I did want to talk just a few comments specifically about the Troutdale Master Plan that concluded last year. And at the outset, we went into this not sure how the airport would look moving into the future. And of particular interest was the runway length and the operational and financial impacts that were associated with the varying lengths of that runway. And there was significant analysis and robust discussion with a PAC that we had for an almost two-year period. The demand forecast, which we is a process we go through with the FAA, actually identified a runway that would only be 3,600 feet. But after we had a lot of engagement with our PAC, they endorsed a runway length of 4,500 feet. And at the conclusion of the process, we were comfortable with that approach because that would give us some flexibility to meet the community and the market demands for both the current and potential future operation. We thought this was a really good example of how we engaged with the community, their voices were heard, and the stakeholders had a direct impact on how the airport can grow over the next few decades. In Hillsborough, we've just completed a decade of public involvement through our Hillsborough Airport Roundtable, or HAIR, committee. This committee was formed as a direct result and a recommendation of the 2005 Hillsborough Airport Master Plan, which was also guided by a Planning Advisory Committee, or PAC. The HAIR committee, in cooperation with the port staff, developed a fly-friendly program, which we used to educate pilots and students about aircraft operations with the goal of reducing aircraft noise exposure for the surrounding communities. HAIR also studied the local market for unleaded aviation fuel, and as a result, the ports invested our own funds into the rehabilitation of a fuel storage and dispensing tank, and these are ready to go in anticipation of a new unleaded avgas, should that be approved by the FAA by the end of 2018. This month, we're launching a Hillsborough Airport Master Plan update that'll guide the airport over the next 20 years. And the advisory committee that we've developed will represent diverse airport interests and explore economic development, sustainability, and equity in the planning process. This focus on equity involves former airport advisory committee members, community organizations, local government, and airport businesses. And talking about the governance structure, the port currently has a 9-member commission, as you know, appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. The commission sets the port policy and represents broad statewide interests. And at least two commissioners must live in each one of the three counties in the port district, Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas. The remaining members may live in any part of the state, and we've had representation from southern, eastern, central, and coastal Oregon. As we have a state-mandated mission, we believe this geographic diversity seems appropriate. Inserting a 9-member elected authority for each airport that doesn't have direct oversight from the Port Commission could essentially tie the hands of the existing commission. This is particularly important because the Port Commission manages a portfolio that includes not only the three airports of Hillsborough, PDX, and Troutdale, but also our extensive maritime and industrial facilities. The commission has to balance budgets and allocate resources across this portfolio, and their ability to do this job effectively could be hamstrung by the creation of these two new authorities with no involvement in or responsibility for overall port governance. And lastly, just talking a little bit about the financial impact, it's essential to understand that these GA airports, Troutdale and Hillsborough, are not financially self-sustaining, and they don't receive property taxes. PDX, Hillsborough, and Troutdale are run as a system of airports, both operationally and financially. The Port Commission is responsible for prioritizing the limited financial resources that we have in the aviation system. The Troutdale Airport doesn't generate enough money to cover all of its operating expenses every year, nor does it generate enough cash flow for capital investment. Any shortfall in the operating income or capital funding not covered by grants is covered through PDX. And over the last 10 years, PDX has invested $10 million to keep Troutdale open and operating. The expected shortfall in the next 5 years from PDX, or excuse me, at Troutdale, is about $5 million, which includes runway rehabilitation, taxiway work, and other day-to-day expenses. Hillsborough does generate enough cash flow to cover its operating expenses, but not the capital. Over the last 10 years, PDX invested almost $25 million to cover the Hillsborough shortfall. And the expected financial shortfall to be covered by revenues at PDX is another $27 million over the next 5 years, which includes more runway and taxiway work, the master plan study, and other operating expenses. The creation of these two new airport authorities would threaten this existing inner airport support network. The FAA and the port's bond ordinances allow the port to use this revenue generated from parking, ground transportation, to subsidize both Hillsborough and Troutdale because of their status as reliever airports. So, to summarize, the port's proud of our strong partnership we have across the region, including local governments, chambers of commerce, community organizations, individuals and businesses, and that bring huge economic benefits to the region and the state. We hope you look through the testimony submitted on the record highlighting these points, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have on any of the points I've raised.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes.
Senator?
So, no questions, but thank you for that. That was a very good description of the interplay between the airports, and I'm glad that you came and gave that testimony. Thank you very much.
Okay. Anything else? Mm. Senator?
Yeah, I've dealt with airports. Well, I mean, this committee's dealt with airports quite a bit. And I'll say one thing, they're just not very popular. Having said that, all the studies show that, you know, if we do have a big earthquake event, it's going to be airports and maybe ports that where the relief comes from. So rural airports especially are extremely important. And for the city of Hillsborough and Troutdale, that might be their only source of getting the necessary things that they need. If there is a major earthquake event, so to turn it over to kind of a neighborhood association is that doesn't really want the airport is a little bit hard for me to swallow.
I don't think there's a question there, but okay.
No question.
Anybody else?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see. Next, let's have Jim. Boy. From Washington County. And Mike Barnes. I don't want to murder your name.
It's Mickey Barnes.
Huh?
Mickey Barnes. Not Mike. Mickey.
Well, there's Mickey. Oh, it looked like Mike. I'm sorry.
Good afternoon. I guess I'll go ahead and start. I'm Jim Lubisher, and I'm a resident.
I apologize for not doing your name right.
Fine. Lubisher. I'm a resident of Washington County, and I'm in support of the 128 bill. First, we have to understand what Hillsborough Airport is. It's, it was mentioned it's a reliever airport, and I guess supposedly that's accurate, but it's really a flight training airport. The vast majority of operations there are flight training. And flight training differs from just regular airplanes that go from here to there. They just stay in circle and circle and circle all over, all the time over our neighborhoods. And over rural Washington County, so it's a little different. It's really primarily a flight training facility. It's a very busy facility, as you know. Now, I wish I could give you the exact numbers of the training operations, but apparently the Port of Portland doesn't even know that, which I think is really outstanding. They don't know the how their operations are divvied up there. We know at least two-thirds or so of the local operations seem to be flight training operations. That was from years ago in a report for some report. And then there's the non-local operations. But it's basically a flight training airport. And these, the local ones, fly at low altitudes. And There is a federal regulation for safety where aircraft have to be above the highest obstacle within whatever. They have to be 1,000 feet above the highest tree, say, within a certain amount of. But that doesn't apply in Hillsborough because there is an exception. The exception is they don't have to abide by the safety regulations if they are in the process of taking off or landing, which makes sense, of course. You start at ground zero. But these airplanes, going directly away from the runway, they're flying lower than the safety regulations. But they get through based on that exception. So they are there's a safety concern there. That's the type of airport we have there. And the adverse effects from that kind of activity, especially the flight training, includes noise, basically, interferes with quality of life and health effects, too. There's safety aspects, which I mentioned with the exceptions to that low-altitude flying for landings and takeoffs. There's also been waivers given to the military shows at the air show. They have to get waivers of that regulation. It's one of the ones, safety regulations that they get waivers to. Security is another concern there, especially after 9/11. You basically could walk on that airport and get to a plane easily. I don't want to try that, but I think it'd be possible. And of course, there's the issue of the pollution, not only lead pollution, which is a major issue, but other pollution. Fiscally, as I've learned more and more about the airport, as you heard, it's not self-sufficient. I think I heard that they covered their operational costs with Hillsborough did in the last year or two. But the reports I have show a $1 to $2 million deficit in 2015 and 16. Now that's some new information that I'm looking at right now. That doesn't include the loss of property taxes to Washington County on that property. So we have concerns. I was initially concerned mostly about noise because I have the plane coming low in over me all the time. Then I became more concerned about other things, which I just mentioned. So I would go to the HAIR meetings in 2011. 15 of the 19 members of the HAIR committee were basically representatives of the aviation committee. So recommendations that came out of the committee were primarily aviation biased, I would say. That committee was eventually disbanded this past year or so. Now, the Port of Portland is a proprietor, and they could do some regulation, but they're hamstrung. They put themselves in a position of hamstringing themselves on doing any sort of operational controls because of federal grant assurances. The city, I thought, would have some basis to use their power of police powers. But according to the Port's legal department, quote, the city has no legal authority to impose curfews or place restrictions on flight operations. My concern is that the Port of Portland does not have elected officials, commissioners. They're appointed by the governor, as you heard, and they're not put up for a vote. I mean, they're not elected. So I support this bill. I mean, maybe the whole commissioners of the Port of Portland should be elected, I would say. But also, I think this is a good move. And I don't think this is going to be terribly disruptive. There'll be some work to coordinate with the Port of Portland. But it would give the Washington County residents some means to influence those thoughts of and actions of those commissioners. As far as earthquakes go, I think that is a concern. I have talked to geologists who do have concerns that a lot of the airfields are not going to survive anyway. But that is a concern, but I don't think that should be the overriding issue here. Separate Board of Commissioners can certainly take that into consideration with how they manage the airport. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, ma'am.
Okay. I'm Mickey Barnes, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Thank you so very much for hearing my testimony. And thank you, Senator Riley, for sponsoring this bill. It is much appreciated. You know, I am, like Jim, I'm in support of this bill that typically municipalities in this state, and the port is a municipality, refers to cities and counties, and they have elected representatives. The port claims to be a municipality, but it's in large part a corporation. So it has these broad, far-reaching powers of a municipality, acts, you know, as a corporate business, but the people impacted by it have no right to vote. Nor do we have access to the members of the commission. For you, and I'm very grateful for this, I can just get on the internet and your names pop up, your email addresses, your phone numbers. That is not the case for the port commissioners, even though there was talk about there's two from Washington County, two from Clackamas County, two from Multnomah County. We do not have access to them. We send something to a P.O. box. I couldn't even tell you their names. And they do not come out to the community to meet people, unless it's the corporate interest. But they certainly haven't come out to a public meeting to get acquainted. You know, this is very troubling. I mean, we fought a revolution in this country because of taxation without representation. That's, you know, the historical lesson every school child gets. Yet in Oregon, this right of the port to tax the community, and if you look at your property taxes, if you live in the Tri-County area, you will see that you're being taxed every single year. And yet you have no vote. They can issue eminent domain, they can pass ordinances, but you can't vote for the people doing this. So, I mean, we're just asking for democracy. This is not unusual. I mean, their model is similar to, I mean, you could say that Intel is a very successful corporation, or Providence Hospitals hires a lot of people. Are you going to make them a municipality? I mean, it's the same kind of model. Are we going to turn this government over to corporations, or will it be a democracy, a government of, by, and for the people? I support the latter. And I will say that for years, if the port had been responsive to me, my concerns about noise, lead, toxic pollutants, and they're pumping easily a ton of lead into the environment every year on a community that's 25% children and 40% Hispanic. If they had been responsive to community concerns, I personally wouldn't be here today. You know, I would be at home enjoying my own property. That has been taken away from me. It has, and I also want to say that I've looked at the FAA register. Nearly half of the aircraft at that airport are registered to companies owned, partly owned, or managed by Max Lyons. And he, you know, manages and is part owner of this massive international flight training school. They're recruiting people from all over the world, bringing them to this community. But this airport, only 708,000 operations in 2007 were corporate jets. That was less than 3% of total operations. That was in their environmental assessment. I didn't pull this out of a hat. We drew that data from out of the environmental assessment. So most of it is flight training and recreational pilots. Does that mean anything about me? Doesn't mean my time is up.
No. Take all the time you need.
Okay. So, you know, just to make that point that they're really facilitating these private businesses, I read in the paper just a few months ago, never discussed it here, never discussed it the community, just this announcement that Horizon is going to start offering jet flight training at this airport. Did I have a vote in that? Did anybody look at the environmental impacts? I mean, airports are known to be major emitters of PM 2.5, the jets, And, you know, we're flirting with Clean Air Act violations in Hillsborough and Washington County. But this was never discussed. And this is typical of how the port has done business. So I am a supporter of livability, of the environment, and of democratic process. You know, does the port want to forfeit its municipality status? I'm for that, too. You know, if they don't want to abide by the principles of a democratic society. So I guess that's... I could go on all day, as you might have guessed, but I'll be merciful.
I think we get the drift.
Yeah.
Questions from the panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Okay, let's see here. Elizabeth Howell and Mike Fries.
Just in time.
Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Elizabeth Howe, here representing the Portland Business Alliance. Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for allowing me to comment on this bill today. The Portland Business Alliance represents 1,800 small, medium, and large employers in the Portland region, and our mission is to foster an environment that attracts, supports, and retains private sector jobs. The Hillsborough and Troutdale airports are important assets to the Portland business community. They allow the efficient access to other economic hubs across the country. The Port of Portland has managed these airports well, in our view, and we're concerned that the stability and efficiency of airport operations would be at risk if an additional governing body were added to the existing port framework. So for these reasons, we urge your opposition to Senate Bill 128, and thank you for your consideration of our comments.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Fries with Associated Oregon Industries, represent approximately 1,500 businesses from across the state, including those that use the Troutdale and Hillsborough airports for service and the Port of Portland. Senate Bill 128 proposes to create new governance structures for Hillsborough and Troutdale airports. As I mentioned, these airports provide critical air service to some of Oregon's largest employers in the Hillsborough and Troutdale areas, and provide important relief services from PDX. And as probably been mentioned, I'm sorry, I was testifying in another hearing and made it just in time, but as it's probably been mentioned, the FAA allows PDX to use discretionary funds to help support Troutdale and Hillsborough air services. And so this new governance structure may compromise some of those funds and then also compromise the service. So we would ask that the committee oppose the bill based on those issues, and would be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. And next we have Deanna Palm, and I think it's Jerry Wiley.
Willie.
Huh?
Jerry Willie.
Willie.
I've been called worse.
He is wily, but, you know.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Thank you so much for allowing me this opportunity. Deanna Palm, President of the Hillsborough Chamber of Commerce. Hillsborough Airport is an integral part of the region's transportation system, providing the highest standard of general aviation facilities to business and residents of Washington County and beyond. The most recent economic impact shows that the Hillsborough Airport generated 1,746 jobs at the airport and the community, $93 million in personal income, and more than $124 million in business revenue. I do have prepared comments, but many of the things I was going to talk about have already been stated. So rather than repeat that, I would just like to speak from my personal experience in my capacity at the Hillsborough Chamber for the past 15 years and working with the Port of Portland. We're very close to the Hillsborough Airport and obviously an important part of our community. I served on the master plan update that happened most recently. I was part of the HARE committee that was an outgrowth of that and participated in many of their their meetings, and have always found that the Port of Portland listened and provided ample opportunity for community members to express their concerns about what was happening, whether that was noise, lead, operations, those kinds of things. Could they always fix every single problem? No. Did that create frustration? Absolutely. But always willing to listen, try to find a way, looking to mitigate to the best of their ability these issues. Looking forward to the next master plan update. They have I think it's an 18-member advisory committee, again, that is completely filled with community members, business community, people that are obviously involved in aviation operations as well. Many opportunities for the community to be engaged in this process. I know that people will show up, and I know that there will be an opportunity for the advisory committee members to take input and listen to what it is that they're saying and be a part of that conversation and that dialogue. The Hillsborough Airport is an integral portion of our community. It's a great asset for our businesses and for our community members, and we think that the governance that currently is afforded the Port of Portland is adequate, and we look forward to working with them as we move forward in the master plan development.
Thank you. Sir?
Chair Beyer and committee members, thank you very much. Jerry Willie, I'm the former mayor of Hillsborough for the past 8 years, and hence why I'm referred to by some as the old mayor, but I don't really endorse that very well. I also am currently the chair of the Hillsborough Master Plan Committee, which has just been organized and structured. Our first meeting is next Monday, and it's going to be a two-year endeavor. Members, as Deanna pointed out, members of that committee do represent a cross-section of not only the community. We have seven citizens, seven of the 15, actually, are citizens at large. We have a youth representative, and, of course, then we have the City of Hillsborough, Port of Portland, FAA, and a few of the other aviation geeks that will be sitting on that committee as well. And I think the important part of that committee, from my standpoint, and why I agreed to be chair, is because it is physically located. The Hillsborough Airport is physically located in the center of our city. It's across the street from 100 acres that's owned by Washington County, called the Fairgrounds. The county has embarked on an event center, building an event center right straight across the street from the airport. There's a hotel there that is also managed by the port, and that is going to be an economic increase in the area and certainly for the county as we bring tourists and visitors to our area. The airport is a significant economic development aspect that the City of Hillsborough, quite frankly, has enjoyed for a very, very long time. Notably, Nike and Intel are critical aspects and certainly users of that airport every day. We have a variety of other businesses that are also that use the airport and certainly enjoy the economic benefits of that. I live physically a half a mile, and if I was punny, I would say as the crow flies, to the airport. And I get to enjoy some of the same sounds that come from an airport, a.k.a. small airplanes flying over the top of my house on occasion. Interestingly, I knew that airport was there when I moved there 10 years ago. I knew that. I enjoy airports. I enjoy aviation. I was in the Navy aviation of things on aircraft carriers, so I enjoy that part of it. But I certainly knew full well in advance when I moved there that there was going to be airport noise, and that was a part of the economic development. So you can hear noise or you can hear the sound of money, because that's what both of those sounds emulate. So I would just like to say you've heard the economic impact that this may have on both the Troutdale and on the Hillsborough Airport. You've heard the concerns about the FAA funding a committee such as this bill would create. And certainly there are a number of other issues just with the creation of this committee and creation of this bill that are concerning to not only to the port, but to the City of Hillsborough. And I need to emphasize the fact that I am not speaking on behalf of the City of Hillsborough. So I am a representative and certainly chair. I want to make sure that I made that perfectly clear. We have, as a city and certainly as a region, we have enjoyed the benefits of having that airport there. I think, interestingly enough, when we start talking about earthquakes and we talk about the benefits of having an airport close to you for certainly the rescue aspect of earthquakes, that's something that's almost in every conversation now, and that certainly would be true and certainly would be a benefit to have for the citizens of Hillsborough, if nothing else. Should that earthquake occur in our lifetimes. So with that, I appreciate the time that you've given me to speak in opposition of this bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Senator.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. These two folks have been really instrumental in Hillsborough for a long time, and I appreciate them coming down and speaking to us. We'll certainly take all this into consideration. Thank you very much for coming down.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Monroe?
I just thought the old mayor should know that he's speaking to the oldest committee in the legislature today by average age by far. We're it.
So I can feel really good about this, huh?
especially the two ends.
If it wasn't for me, that number would be really high.
Yeah, me too.
Enough with the age. Okay. Thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you.
That's all I have on my list. Is there anybody else who wishes to address this bill? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 128, and we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 189. Patrick.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 189 establishes a task force on airport subsidies. The task force would operate and then sunset on December 31st, 2019. There's an emergency clause on this measure. The measure also has a subsequent referral to the Committee on General Government and Accountability, as well as the Committee on Ways and Means. It's my understanding that this session, as a matter of course, all measures dealing with task forces have a subsequent referral to general government and accountability. And, of course, anything with an expenditure will have a Ways and Means subsequent referral, Mr. Chair.
Certainly. Let's see. Mike Barnes.
Mickey.
Oh. Mickey.
Mickey, but I'm sorry. I did it again, didn't I? Yeah. And Jim, and you want to come up again same time? Jody, if you want to come up same time too, that's fine.
Let me move down. Who wants to start? Do you want to start? Okay. Okay. I'm Mickey Barnes, and I'm here to, Chair Byer, members of the committee, thank you for, again, hearing this testimony. But I'm here in support of Senate Bill 189. Over the years, I've read a number of Connect Oregon proposals, and I've truly been troubled by them. Many of them were not tied with creating jobs at all, even though that was the initial incentive. But let me tell you about one. The Port of Portland submitted a proposal for the Hillsborough Airport third runway several years ago. And just to give a little background, we challenged the third runway environmental assessment, a group of citizens. And we initially won a remand from the Ninth Circuit Court. And so the port submitted a supplemental assessment, which we again challenged. We were very concerned about the lead issue, noise, a number of other issues. The port nonetheless went ahead and built that runway anyway. And the Ninth Circuit still hasn't ruled on it. Now, part of their reasoning behind that was because they had been given a Connect Oregon grant for $4 million to help build the runway. The runway was approximately $17 million. Most of the money came from the FAA, but they did get a $4 million grant. Now, to be clear, the port's master plan and a former director Mary Maxwell, both were very clear that this runway was primarily to serve the flight training industry. It was for smaller aircraft, and these are the ones that are the worst offenders in terms of lead emissions and repetitive noise. So, you know, they essentially used Connect Oregon as an excuse for why they had to hurry up, build that runway without a court decision, because the state would withdraw the money if they didn't. So, again, we're still waiting for the Ninth Circuit Court to make their decision. So, you know, that is of concern. But I've seen other proposals, like at the Bend Airport, two Connect Oregon grants, primarily for, what is it, Leading Edge? I believe it's Leading Edge. It's helipads. You know, why is the public paying for helipads for private companies and private airports? Where is the public benefit? Only 0.6% of the population of Oregon is a registered pilot. And that number is also true on a national level, when I think there's something like less than 6,000 registered pilots in the entire country. Yet the state has allocated, since 2005, close to $100 million to these airports. And some of them, like at McMinnville, it was to promote the agribusiness winery. And in the proposal, they talked at length about all the jobs because of Evergreen Airport and so forth. Well, Evergreen went belly up before the money was ever allocated. The jobs, I mean, people were suing Evergreen because they weren't being paid. Employees were not being paid. Businesses were not being paid. None of that was reconsidered. Connect Oregon gave them the money. And I'm just concerned. It seems like when the situation changes, the jobs really aren't there. This was major. I still see articles in the paper about this Evergreen mess. And nobody withdrew the proposal and said, whoa, back to the drawing board. They just gave them the money. And this is happening time after time after time. Now, in the meanwhile, we see our highways and our bridges falling into disrepair. We see children being shortchanged in their education. We see a toothless DEQ that has no real oomph to promote environmental safeguards. I mean, we're seeing this systematically across government. Why are we giving all this money to some of the wealthiest people in the state? I like to see this review of these subsidies, and I like them reviewed carefully, because a similar one happened at the Salem Airport, which they did withdraw, quite frankly, because the whole proposal was based on having Delta there as a commercial carrier, and that all failed. And so they did withdraw the Connect Oregon money there. But another one was that, what was it, Seaport? Where they were traveling to these little airports in Oregon with one passenger, and they got this, I can't remember the number, it seems like $20 million. I mean, it's huge, huge amounts of money. I'll have to go back. Don't quote me on that figure. I'll go back and look at the data, but this is startling when we see the need in this state for so many basic human services. So I ask you to support this airport subsidy, and I ask you even further, and I don't know what your role is here, to think very carefully about more airport subsidies through Connect Oregon. Largely, if you look, even with all these subsidies, if you go to the Department of Aviation website, you look at their annual reports, turn to the back of them, you'll see that most state airports are operating in the red. You know, the ports own Troutdale Airport for 70 years. You would think after 70 years, it would be a viable business. They've owned Hillsboro Airport for over 50 years. I mean, what's going on? Is this a viable business model? Would we not be better off to invest in high-speed trains up the Cascadia Corridor or education? I just hope you'll give it due consideration.
Get your point.
Yeah.
Who's next?
Jim Lubisher, just to be brief, from resident of Washington County. I was concerned with the Connect Oregon funds and how they were passed out. And my understanding of Connect Oregon was to connect Oregon, this city to that city and transportation needs. Again, I'd emphasize that the Hillsboro Airport, again, is predominantly a flight training airport. They don't go anywhere. They just go up in the air and then they come back down, pretty much. So there's to use Connect Oregon funds to support a runway for the flight training company, who's owned by two investment firms. One, their bases are in New York and Pennsylvania and I think Brazil. To use Connect Oregon funds for a runway for the Hillsboro Airport for that flight training school, I think is inappropriate, and I support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. I was really glad to see this study proposed because, like these two, I've seen an awful lot of subsidy going to the use of very few people without a lot of oversight. When we were looking at fuel prices for aviation and saw that ours was a penny a gallon and in other states it's much higher, it made me really wonder. So I, a couple years ago, collected the data that's on that my testimony, where California is charging 27 cents a gallon, Washington 4, at that time Oregon was at 1, we're now at 3, Colorado 12.7 cents. So I called Colorado and I asked, because I remembered that they had gotten a whole new airport, right? How did you get your airport, and how do you pay for small airports and improvements in your state? And that I was told I would be embarrassed to ask the legislature for money that should be in the general fund in order to do anything for airports. And then as we talked, after a while, he remembered, oh, wait, we did get some money from the state once. We were putting some beacons on hills and stuff, and we didn't have enough money, and we asked for a few $100,000. And it does make sense that the expenses at airports should be paid for by the people who use airports. The idea that we must have them for emergencies is not very logical because small aircraft isn't how most emergency equipment is delivered. Helicopters or huge planes are used, not little planes that need runways and stuff. And as I've watched Connect Oregon, I've seen some pretty outrageous ideas, like the Sisters Airport wanted lighting and a system that would bring in planes safely after work. Well, nobody pays to turn on the garage lights at my house. So why are we doing that for people who are flying airplanes into Sisters? If they wanted lights there, they needed to put lights there, is kind of how it felt to me. And it feels like an abuse of funds that so much money is being used this way. And just last night I was talking to someone and realized that not only are we funding airports through our property taxes and our Connect Oregon, but we also have a list of several million dollars of requests for bonding funds through the bonding bills. And I didn't realize we did it that way. The total, since we started Connect Oregon, the total funding for airports is at $107 million. That's $18 million a biennium. That's quite a hunk of money. And there are also property tax exemptions for the facilities at airports. So you can have a hangar for your plane and not pay property taxes. That doesn't make sense to me. But that seems to be the case. And so I think that we do need to look and see what we're doing and whether it makes sense. Thank you.
Thanks, Judy. Senator Riley?
So this is not my bill. But we all know
Jody, and she's been in front of us a lot, but you don't know the other two very well, and I do. I was a member of the Hare Board, and they've been in front of that board a long time. You can tell that Ms. Barnes knows her stuff and does her research. She's very good at doing research and letting us know what she's doing. So.
Any other questions? Thank you. Go ahead.
Can I make one more comment?
Sure.
I also wanted to mention at Santa Monica Airport, they're a general aviation airport like Hillsborough, but they have half as many operations. And it's an airport that's owned and operated by the city. It's very controversial right now. A lot of people in the community want to shut it down, so there's a lot of lawsuits and FAA and all that sort of thing. But a few years ago, they looked at, I think there was like a $13 million cost overrun. What they did, and if you go to Santa Monica City Code under airports, you can find it. They instituted a landing fee on all aircraft. Here at Hillsborough, for instance, the landing fee is only on aircraft over 10,000 pounds. Well, what Santa Monica did is they based it on 1,000 pounds of weight. And this way, you know, all the flight training aircraft had to pay for the use of the airport. You know, as it is, you know, all these students being recruited from all over the world aren't really paying any landing fees whatsoever. And so the airports are coming up short, and they're coming here to the legislature and saying, we need help, we're not breaking even. But why not institute things like the increase in gas taxes, landing fees, user fees, so that the people who are using these airports are the ones who are paying for them rather than the general public? This is a luxury. Most of us, you know, can't afford to fly, to own a private plane or helicopter or jet. You know, it is a luxury by any stretch of the imagination.
Get it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any others? I don't see it. Thank you very much. That's all I have signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify? Oh, come on down.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Mitch Schwecker. I'm the director of the Department of Aviation. I just wanted to come in and just clear up a few things. First of all, I'm firmly committed both ways on this bill. I think it's a great idea to look into aviation funding and subsidies. I think what we'll find out is that it's really a good news story. The FAA and all financial revenue from airports has to go back to the airports. It can't be diverted or directed someplace else. It has to go into airports. And what I've passed out here is an example of the good news story that I talked about. And that is, if you look at the chart and you look at aviation, now this is prior to Connect 6, but the amount of money that went from Connect Oregon to airports is $86 million, and you just heard that it was 100 and something million. So, but if you look over in the fourth column, the leverage dollars, that's money that primarily came from the FAA. That's four times the amount of money from Connect Oregon, and it came into the state from the federal government. When they ask for grants for Connect Oregon, they're not looking for an entire project cost. They're looking for 10%. And that 10%, or 5% in some cases, is the amount of dollars that leverages that federal dollar amount. And if you look at the chart there, that's 59% of all the leveraged dollars, the money that comes from Connect Oregon of any mode. So I just wanted to clear that up. And I think that's all I have.
Okay. Any questions, Mitch? Oh, yeah, sure.
Very quickly. So on both of these columns, column two and column four, those are all taxpayer money, is that right?
Those are all... The Connect Oregon dollars are lottery dollars, I think you're aware. And then the leverage dollars is from the FAA, and that's from the Aviation Trust Fund. It comes from mostly user fees, revenue, PFCs.
Good, thank you.
It's all trust fund.
Okay. Anybody else? Hey, Mitch. Anybody else? Seeing none, we are done. We close public hearing and Patrick's or anything else? I don't think so. We are adjourned. They rot.